In the summer, Northern Soundings takes a break. This year, I'm delighted to reintroduce a new generation to a wonderful series KUAC broadcast some 30 years ago. Sunday at Noon, and later Conversations, featured Susan McGinnis talking with some historically significant and thoughtful people about Alaska. Susan has selected some former discussions for this summer series. This show, Susan talks with George Sundborg, who helped craft Alaska's Constitution. The show originally aired in 1989. It suffered a few audio problems, but because of its historical significance, I've applied some judicious editing and posted a short break. Here's Susan introducing George Sundborg.
In 1938, the whole of Alaska, 586,000 square miles, twice the size of Texas, contained a few more than 70,000 souls. About 32,000 of those were Native Alaskans, and just under 40,000 non-Native. Relative to this latter number in his book Opportunity in Alaska, George Sundborg wrote, "Someone once went to the trouble of computing the average length of residence of all the white people who ever lived in Alaska, and he found it to be about 3 weeks." I'm Susan McGinnis for KUAC-FM. My guest for the next hour is one of those three-weekers, George Sundborg himself. He landed in Juneau in 1938, pen in hand, then roughly 25 years old and a journalist. Over the next years, he would write for the Juneau Empire, edit the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, and found a competing voice in Juneau, the Juneau Independent. He would also forge a 30-year bond and a working relationship with Ernest Greening, himself a pivotal personality in Alaska history and politics, as territorial governor, then the territory's representative to the Senate, finally, the first senator from the state of Alaska. George Sundborg worked closely with Greening over their 30-year friendship. He managed his campaigns for the Senate and served as Senator Greening's administrative assistant in Washington for a decade. Mr. Sundberg's careers in journalism, in civil service, and politics span a period of great dreams and great growth for Alaska, for during these years, the territory began to rise out of the frontier. World War II welded it to the nation, leaving behind a network of roads, ports, airfields, and of expectations. And for some, fortunes were made, where others found only dust. Statehood was fought for and attained, and the population doubled and doubled again. Good afternoon, Mr. Sundborg, and thank you.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here at the university.
In the Opportunity for Alaska, you wrote of the tug of the North, and of it you said the American character, which vibrated in response to the appeal of open land, to the challenge of undeveloped country, brought people north. Did you feel that vibration in that tug, and is that what brought you to Alaska?
Yes, it certainly did, and it was. And I believe that that still exists. It's a great power. I have often said that I think in the long range of time, Alaska will become not the least populous state or the second least, which I guess it is today, but one of the more populous states. Anchorage at the time had only something like 4,000 people, mm-hmm. and Fairbanks had even fewer than that. Juneau had, as I remember it, something around 9,000. Of course, these are all pretty small potatoes compared with today, and we know that both Fairbanks and Anchorage have grown mightily, while Juneau has maybe doubled in population or done a little better than that, but up here it has been, you know, to a degree of 100 to 1 almost.
But in that day, it must have made for Juneau a bustling community.
Yes, it was. And of course, it was then, as it still is, the capital. It was the capital, however, of a territory which in which the people had very limited participation in their own government. The governor, who was a federal appointee, himself had very limited powers, and the legislature was surrounded by all kinds of prohibitions in the Organic Act, so that it was not able to strike out very boldly and do things that everybody up here could see needed to be done to push Alaska forward.
It's some examples of what the constraints were, what couldn't be done.
All right. The legislature was forbidden to do anything about the disposal of land in Alaska. It was prevented from taxing, except in a very narrow range. It, of course, had no powers to control the principal industry of Alaska at that time, which was the fisheries. The fisheries, the game, the forests, and everything else in Alaska were controlled by federal bureaus. And Alaskans had already begun to see the depletion, particularly of the runs of salmon, which had supported a great industry. And that was all going downhill.
The money was going outside as quickly as it was made, and the salmon were being fished out?
That's right. We were overfishing, and the money did go outside. Of course, the capital investment for these enterprises, like canneries and fishing boats and so on, mainly came from outside and very largely from the state of Washington, mm-hmm. from Seattle and Bellingham and other ports on Puget Sound.
You know, there's a passage I remember. This is also found in your book, Opportunity in Alaska, and it's Ernest Greening, then the governor, territorial governor, addressing the legislature in 1941, and I'll read bits and pieces here. The thought, he says, is quite strong. It must be clear that today, still far too much survives in Alaska of the earlier practice of take it all out, take it down below, leave as little as possible, spend nothing in Alaska. We like to boast in retrospect how wise old Bill Seward was, and how in exchange for the $7,200,000 he paid for this territory, it has poured $2 billion worth of fisheries, minerals, and furs into the nation's economy. Quite true. It was a wonderful buy. Alaska has enriched the nation, but it has done relatively little for itself. He finishes by saying the time has come when an increasing proportion of that wealth should be kept in Alaska for the further development, progress, and improvement of Alaska and the Alaskans.
I was there when that message to the legislature was delivered by the rather newly arrived senator who had,
then governor.
I get mixed up on what to call him. He was then the governor and only later became a senator. But the legislature had never heard from one of its governors a message of this kind. Usually the governors would give a brief report on what commerce had existed between the territory of Alaska and the then 48 states in the preceding year or biennium. They would say something about what the population was thought to be, and they would leave it at that. And the legislature would then proceed to deal with the what they thought were the pressing issues of the day within their powers. I remember that in the first session of the legislature that I covered, the biggest problem that was before the legislature was in the form of a bill called the Cocktail Bill. And this was a proposal to allow liquor by the drink to be sold in Alaska. Mm. Ever since the ever since Prohibition had been repealed, although it was possible to go down and buy a bottle of liquor at a liquor store, it had not yet been authorized in Alaska that bars could sell mixed drinks. It seems a little hard to believe now, doesn't it, in Alaska mm-hmm. that we know.
Definitely.
But this bill was before the legislature, and they argued it up one side and down the other and finally passed a bill that did allow for the first time in 1939 a person to go down and order a dry martini.
So roughly at this time, Ernest Greening arrived in 39. Actually, he'd come in 36, taken a quick tour, and then returned as the territorial governor after his predecessor had died. He must have been an odd duck, both because he didn't speak the federal line, but also, if not moreover, because he was an Easterner, well-to-do as far as I can tell, very well-educated, went to Harvard, Harvard Medical School, became a journalist, worked for the feds, and then arrives on whose doorstep? On Alaska's doorstep? Was he the odd duck I take him to be?
Yes, he was speaking a language which had not been spoken in Alaska theretofore. I should correct one assumption that you just put into words, and that was that his predecessor had died. His predecessor was John W. Troy, who had resigned in 1939, but did not die until several years thereafter. He was always in poor health from the time I arrived in Alaska.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of a conversation between George Sundborg and the host, Susan McGinnis. We'll return after this break. This week, we're rebroadcasting an interview Susan McGinnis originally aired on KUAC in 1989. It's with George Sundborg, former territorial newspaperman and one of the crafters of Alaska's Constitution. When Ernest Greening was made territorial governor in Alaska, he quickly ran afoul of some vested interests, as George Sundborg makes clear.
The number one opponent of all of the Greening initiatives was the Alaska salmon industry, which was owned outside of Alaska, which had a power over the legislature which was in no degree less controlling than that which Big Oil has over the legislature of Alaska in 1989. And the legislators, many of them had been elected because they were supported by funds that were given to their campaigns by the Alaska salmon industry and by other emoluments which were held out to them. And they just, the salmon industry was not about to see new schools located or health programs instituted or welfare provisions made, because these things would cost money and the salmon industry would be expected to pay its share of the costs of these new things in government.
Can you describe that extrication, if there was one, from the legislature, from the salmon industry? I'm interested in your comment when you said that they oversaw the legislature much as oil does today.
And well, the salmon industry at that time and for many years thereafter had as its principal representative at the legislative sessions a man named W.C. Arnold, often called Judge Arnold, though the only claim he had to the title of judge was the fact that he had served as a U.S. commissioner in Ketchikan. And he was a very able advocate of the point of view of the salmon industry. But more than talking openly and making arguments in the open legislature, he was extremely adept at maneuvering things back of the scene. And every year, the legislature would enact at its session a tax on canned salmon. It was called a per case tax, and there would be a tax of, say, 2 cents per case on each case of salmon that was canned in Alaska and sent outside. And Arnold would, in plain language, just tell the legislature that this year we will go for a cent and a half and that's all. And the legislature would be found at the end of these sessions to have done exactly what he said was the limit. Now, a few minutes ago I made a mistake when I said he came there each year. The legislature then met only biennially, so there was a session in odd-numbered years, but not in the even-numbered years.
a practice some think should be renewed in this state.
Well, some would argue that.
Right. I guess I'll just pose it again. The process of extrication from the salmon industry, was that accomplished easily or with great difficulty by the legislature or by outside forces?
When you say the process of extrication, I'm not sure you mean just what you mean.
If there was a power held in the state, and for the most part that power was held by the salmon industry, how did they begin to go into decline, or who moved them into decline? How did the legislature come into its own?
All right, that's easy for me to try to approach, and I'll do it this way. They had, as a new opponent, someone with the ability and the leadership qualities which they had never come up against in Alaska before. And this was in the person of Governor Ernest Greening. And he, for the first time, took the salmon industry and other vested interests on for battle. Greening had a substantial career in important positions before he ever came to Alaska. He was editor of a number of newspapers in New York and in Northeastern America. He had been the director of the Division of Territories and Island Possessions of the Interior Department. He had been in charge of very substantial programs in Puerto Rico, and had been an advisor to international conferences that were held respecting Latin America, where, for instance, the Good Neighbor Policy was first developed under President Franklin Roosevelt. And he came up here as a man who knew how to get things done. And he did eventually get things done, but it took a lot of doing.
Roosevelt also supported statehood. Did he select Ernest Greening, do you think, with
the
idea that this man could get it done?
Well, Roosevelt and Greening were old friends. And Greening, of course, had been one of the original New Dealers that came to Washington when Roosevelt was first elected in 1932, and had been an advisor to him. He, as I say, worked in the Interior Department in the Division of Territories. And as time went on, Greening and Harold Ickes, who was the Secretary of the Interior, found themselves at odds over many matters. It wasn't so much a matter of the issues themselves, but of the personalities of the two men. Each one was a driver and a dominator, mm-hmm. and Greening was darned if he was going to be told what to do by Ickes, and Ickes would brook no interference with his ideas by a man who on the organizational charts was his inferior. Mm-hmm. And so it came to a pass where often, after Ickes had laid down the law to Greening, Greening would go around to the back door of the White House, and Franklin Roosevelt would call Harold Ickes and say, I've been talking to Ernest Greening, and I want this matter done this way. Well, that just galled Ickes, mm-hmm. you can believe, knowing his personality, to where he couldn't stand to have Greening around anymore. And I think it was in order to solve this confrontation and remove it from the scene that they found the office of Governor of Alaska and sent Greening as far away as they could think to send him.
Did he have a vision for this state, and do you think that vision stands today?
Oh, indeed he did, and he was able to tell what it was. Early on, he said that Alaska someday should be the 49th state. And that had never been taken seriously as an objective in Alaska. Wickersham, way back many years earlier, several decades earlier, had introduced a bill for admission of Alaska as the 49th state. But it never had a hearing, it had no follow-up, and it had no support either in the territory or nationally. So it didn't get anywhere. And Greening was the man who really brought the vision of statehood to Alaska and eventually sold it to the people. He even had to sell the idea to Bob Bartlett. Bartlett was, when Greening arrived here, the Secretary of Alaska. His predecessor, a man named Ned Griffin, died late in 1938. And the president appointed to succeed Griffin this young man, E.L. Bob Bartlett, who was then working on the staff of delegate in Congress, Tony Diamond, from Alaska. And Bob came up and took that office, as I remember, February or March of 1939. Greening came up and took his office of governor in December of 1939. Bob was filling what up to that time had been a ceremonial office. And Greening thought here was a man who was obviously very able, and he's not doing much of anything, so I'm going to try to put him to work in pursuit of the same objectives which I see for this territory. And so Bob and Ernest worked hand in hand, always with Greening as the older member of the partnership, and they worked very well together. How did we get into this? And let's see. I guess I was trying to say whether. Well, I was saying that I was trying to answer your question of whether it was Greening that had this proposal for state aid. Indeed, he did. And when Tony Diamond was offered a federal judgeship in Anchorage and decided to accept it and to leave the delegate seat in Congress, Greening had a very difficult time persuading Bob Bartlett that he should file for the office and that he should make the central issue of his campaign statehood for Alaska. But Bob eventually did it, and he ran and was elected and became a fearless advocate of statehood, and the two of them worked together very well back in those days, although later in their careers, when both were United States senators, there was rivalry between them and falling off of the great friendship which had welded them together in the 1939-45 period.
Mm-hmm. We're talking today to George Sundberg, journalist, civil servant, watcher of the political scene, who for 10 years worked with Ernest Greening while Ernest Greening was senator from the state of Alaska. We'll talk about this as we move along. I want to enter with you the war years. You've written that two things transformed Alaska, that one was the airplane and the other was World War II. That there's a good chance that if the Japanese had not approached the Aleutians, that second transformation would not have existed at all. I understand Roosevelt had wanted to build some sort of a defense in Alaska in 37 or so, but neither the Navy nor the Army saw a point to it.
Well, that is all very true, and the war did transform Alaska. For the first time, it became visible to everyone, I think, including the military, as you indicate, were rather late coming aboard. Mm-hmm. That this was an area of the world which was highly strategic, and that we needed to defend it, not just for its own sake, but in order to defend the United States. And so, along with the buildup of military facilities in Alaska, came all kinds of transportation and other improvements which remained after the war, and of which we made good utility, and which formed the basis for another surge forward economically.
And you were involved with at least two groups that focused on that potential surge forward, and I'm going to have to stop with the names. One was a New Deal project by
the National Resources Planning Board.
Thank you. By President Roosevelt. And the second one was the Alaska Development Board, and that was a
territorial initiative similar to a state development agency, which was enacted by the territorial legislature in 1945. I became general manager of the Alaska Development Board in September of 1946 and continued in that capacity until 1953.
And both those groups wanted to plan for this state and for its development. What sorts of ideas were considered and planned for, and what worked and what didn't?
The first group, which was the National Resources Planning Board, was in contradistinction to the Alaska Development Board, mm-hmm. concerned really with high-level planning and not going out as the Development Board did and actually trying to put the arm on industries to get them to come up here and locate and build factories and things of that kind. It was purely a planning agency. It did important work, and one of the things it did was to create, along with a matching Canadian staff, a project called the North Pacific Planning Project, and its focus was on the post-war use of the facilities which had been built mm-hmm. during the war, to which we referred a moment ago. These included the Alaska Highway, the Canal Pipeline, the Northwest Staging Route of airports, which came up through Canada and into Alaska, and which in the war had been used for the movement of aircraft after they were manufactured in the United States to Soviet Russia, which was fighting the Nazis on Russia's Western Front. They were short of aircraft. These planes would fly up using these airports through Whitehorse and Fairbanks and Nome, where the aircraft would have the white stars of the United States painted over in red, and they became at that point Soviet warplanes, and the Russian crews got aboard and flew them on across Siberia and to engage in the battles against the Germans in eastern Russia and Poland. And that was one of the things. Then, the increased maritime facilities, the docks and the ships, which existed on the all along the coast of Alaska, which had had to be improved and enhanced and multiplied to supply the troops which were up here in Alaska during the struggle. Well, all of these things we knew were going to still be in place when the war ended. And so before the war ended, the two nations agreed to study what could be done in the way of trying to turn these things to continued civilian use after the war was over. And I was the assistant United States director of that North Pacific planning study.
So these two weren't quite as connected as I think, but they certainly flowed from one to the other, the thoughts about how to demilitarize Alaska and Canada and to use those facilities in the non-fighting years.
That's right, but the Alaska Development Board, which followed a little bit later, was quite different. It actually was one in which I, as general manager, beat the bushes all over the United States principally to try to encourage investment in Alaska, to find, for instance, groups down there which might be willing to come up and look at the possibilities of locating pulp mills. And we did succeed in getting two pulp mills built in Alaska in that period, one in Sitka and the other in Ketchikan, and they are still in production. We also got some new investment in mineral development, for instance, in the only tin mine under the American flag out on the Seward Peninsula. We initiated an instrument which still exists in the form of the Alaska Visitors Association, which we set up in the Development Board, and which has greatly increased the tourist business all over Alaska, and I think is still in its infancy,
mm-hmm.
and will bear lots of great results economically for Alaskans for generations to come.
And you felt that way in the 40s when you were writing
right.
about opportunities for money in Alaska.
And you know, it was still very hard in the late 40s and the early 50s to sell the proposition that it was worthwhile to try to lure travelers and tourists to come to the territory. It was always said, well, if we advertise for them, where are they going to stay when they come up here? We don't have any good hotels. We don't have the facilities that we would need in order to handle tourists, but we brought from Hawaii the head of the Alaska, or of the Hawaii Visitors Association. And he, George Armitage, and I traveled all over Alaska on the dinner and luncheon circuit trying to sell this proposition of a tourist industry which could be rewarding for Alaskans. And we did have success, and we did get the people that were in the airlines and the hotels which then existed, the few tourist bureaus such as that of Chuck West, which was here in Fairbanks, and the steamship companies, to all get together and to approach the territorial legislature with a proposal that they would put up matching money if the territory would do the same, and that this would be used to advertise for people to try to come to Alaska to enjoy some of its beauties. And the first advertisement appeared in Sunset Magazine way back, I think, in about 1951. And I think everyone in Alaska is aware now, you can't pick up a slick printed magazine without seeing a very attractive ad for Alaska, which is which had its beginnings in this endeavor of the Alaska Development Board.
I think we're still begrudging a bit about tourism, where a community like, well, San Francisco, right after the recent earthquake, is saying, we are fine, come back, tourism is our lifeblood, don't change your convention dates. Boldly saying tourism is very important to our economic life, whereas Alaska, I think, is still a little uncomfortable about tourism.
Well, I don't know why it should be, because the tourist brings money in, he takes nothing out, he doesn't pollute the atmosphere, and it's a great, clean business with lots of rewards. It, of course, has grown mightily, and it would have been unthinkable, even at the time that we were trying to spread the gospel up here, that there would be maybe four or five huge cruise ships in the harbor at Juneau all at the same time in the year 1989. And that happens all the time now, all up and down the southeast Alaska coast. They just bring in thousands and thousands of tourists whose main objective, as soon as they hit shore at Ketchikan or Juneau or what other ports they go to, is to, what can I buy in this town, you know?
Sure, as everywhere. You worked for three newspapers while you were in Alaska, one your own. The first one was the Juneau
Empire,
Alaska Daily Empire, Fairbanks Daily News Miner, and then after that began a newspaper in Juneau. I want to ask you about the competing paper with the Empire, but more interestingly for Fairbanks in particular, is your experience in the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. That newspaper is known today as a fairly conservative paper. It's not known for its investigative journalism or for its risk-taking. What was it known for in the 40s? C.W.
Well,
Sneddon's imprint there?
Yes, indeed. I just want to change the order of things a little bit and say that the Juneau Independent, the weekly newspaper, came before I was editor of the Fairbanks News Miner.
Oh, I had them quite confused.
Yes. After I left the development board in 1953, together with several other young men, I was young then, believe it or not.
Of course.
We founded a newspaper called the Juneau Independent, and editorially it took a view rather diametrically opposed to that of the Daily Alaska Empire on most matters in the territory. And we were all for statehood and they were against, and we were for development and they thought things should stay pretty much as they were. And as you probably know, it's hard for a weekly newspaper to compete on an even basis with a daily newspaper. It's like David and Goliath. Mm-hmm. But we did have considerable influence throughout the territory. Then when I had often turned to C.W. Bill Snedden for advice and assistance in putting out that little newspaper. We had a series of mechanical difficulties there, and he was rather a genius at dealing with printing presses and linotype machines, and we came to know one another, and very much to my surprise, early in 1957, he came to Juneau and said to me that his then editor, Jack Ryan, was about to leave to move back to the lower 48, and he wanted to know if I might be interested in coming and being editor of the News Miner. This was a matter of some surprise because everybody knew that Bill Snedden was a diehard Republican, and that George Sundborg was one of these hot dog liberal Democrats. But I came to Fairbanks to look the situation over, and he looked me over. And we did arrive at an understanding, and I did become the editor in April of 1957. I think the principal issue that sold him on me was my longtime support and advocacy of statehood. And that was very dear to Bill Snedden's heart, and it was his, I think, greatest dream that Alaska should become a state. And he thought that his newspaper could play an important role in trying to bring statehood about, and indeed it did. Mm-hmm. You asked me what was the tenor of the News Miner in those days. I would say it, in most matters it was just as conservative as it is today. But on statehood, it was probably the leading advocate anywhere in the territory. There were two other newspapers, well, three actually. There was the Ketchikan Chronicle, there was the Anchorage Daily Times, and there was the little weekly Juneau Independent, aside from the News Miner, which were all very much for statehood. But then there were a number of newspapers, like the Ketchikan Daily News, the Anchorage News, and the Juneau Empire, which were just as firmly opposed. But we thought, when I arrived here and after I had worked here a year or so, that we were making definite headway. And as a matter of fact, statehood did arrive in with the vote of the Senate on June 30th, 1958, to admit Alaska as the 49th state. And I think that the News Miner and Snedden did do a lot to obtain that desired result.
We're talking with journalist George Sundborg, who's visiting the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and we're pleased to have him for this hour on KUAC FM. I want to turn to the nation's Senate, because I think it is an important period both in your career and in Alaska's history. Alaska became a state. It sent one of its longest, proudest advocates, in a way, Ernest Greening, back to his starting place and asked him to advocate then for this state. A general picture to begin of that time. How did it change your lives or the state's life?
Well, I think statehood, of course, revolutionized Alaska. It changed my life mightily. I went from Fairbanks, Alaska to Washington, D.C. I had been there many times before because in the course of the statehood battle, we had had numerous hearings before committees of Congress, and I was usually involved in those appearances. So the scene was not an unfamiliar one to me. And also, I had been there many times in connection with the Alaska Development Board interests, because so many things required changes in legislation, required becoming friendly with people in the federal service who could be of advantage to our progress as a territory. And so when I went down as the administrative assistant to Senator Greening, it was for me on rather familiar ground. We found that statehood and being admitted and putting a new star on the flag did not by any means finish the job of trying to develop Alaska and make it fully self-governing. There followed in the ensuing 2 or 3 years a lot of work which had to be done on what they called the Alaska enabling legislation. There were almost innumerable problems which still remained in connection with correcting laws which had always treated Alaska differently because it was a territory than it treated the states, in transferring federal owned property up here, such as the airports and the federal building in Juneau, which became the state capital, and all kinds of things like that which needed legislative tinkering and correcting.
And was there resistance to those changes?
No.
No, it was all right for Alaska to be fully a state at that
yes,
point.
Yes, oh yes. And we didn't have great difficulty. It just was a tremendous amount of work. Then about in the middle of all of this, there occurred the Alaska earthquake, Good Friday earthquake of
1964.
There was the Fairbanks flood, which had everybody underwater up here. Mm-hmm. And each of those required a lot of federal involvement in the repair of facilities and in the correcting of the causes of those events. For instance, Senator Greening was a member of the Public Works Committee of the Senate and was able to get a flood control project for the Tanana River, which is designed to prevent there ever being a flood of Fairbanks such as occurred in those times.
Mm-hmm. And that project stands well today and for Texas, doesn't it? Yeah.
We hope so.
Right. I was interested in, when I was thinking about your time in the Senate with the senator, about the reaction to the earthquake, inasmuch as the state of California has had to respond to such a terrible quake. Now, less in magnitude, that quake that hit Alaska was, or Anchorage was 8.4.
Right. It was much bigger. It was many times bigger. You know, the way they have the Richter scale set up, you go up about one-tenth of a number, and it's doubled of what the previous one was. So it was by far larger, but it was less destructive in some ways because its epicenter was in a remote place in Prince William Sound, where there were no people, unlike the one in California. And the thing we learned, I didn't know this before, in an earthquake, lives are lost and property is destroyed, not because the earth opens up and swallows somebody, but because the feeble structures of man, which have been improperly built in the first place, tumble down and hit people, and that causes the fatalities. And this is so evident again in the California earthquake.
My grandmother said about the first earthquake that not so many people died, as you say, because the earth opened up, but because when they went back to their homes the next day, they started fires in the stoves so they could cook their breakfast, not remembering that the chimneys had collapsed in there. And so the great fire was started and the lives were lost.
Yeah, right. In Alaska, as I remember it, something like 140 people lost their lives. In California, It's still to be determined, and the latest indication is that the loss of life will be about half of that only. The earthquakes were dissimilar in that the one that they just had in California was centered much more in a highly populated urban setting, while the one up here, while it affected, my goodness, almost every populated place along the south central coast, the biggest being Anchorage, but it also hit with great fury Kodiak and Seward and Valdez and Cordova, and wrought great destruction down there. But altogether, those towns, of course, didn't make up anything like the development which had occurred in San Francisco and which was shaken apart 10 days or so ago.
You managed the senatorial campaigns for Ernest Greening in the first, in 1958, when he first ran, and then his second campaign, which he again won, and the final campaign, which he did not win, against Mike Gravel.
That's true.
I'm curious about the difference between running a campaign in the late 50s and in the 60s and watching campaigns being run in current days. Which do you like best, the 13-week campaign of Ernest Greening in 58?
Well, I like the ones we won, of course. that was the way that they all ought to be. There have been vast differences. The major difference is the sophistication which has been developed in campaign publicity and advertising. The first campaign of Senator Greening in 1958 was one that consisted mainly of the then former governors traveling all over the territory and speaking at meetings and running a few ads, which I wrote myself without the help of any advertising agency, on behalf of his campaign, and getting those into newspapers, working up some few radio advertisements, spots to go on the air, and trying to develop issues which could be debated and laid before the Alaska people, showing that this would be a good man to serve them in the Senate. And that whole campaign did not cost $100,000. In 1962, he had to run again, that although it was only 4 years later. Wait a minute, it was, he had to run again 4 years later because the Senate is so set up that one-third of the senators are elected every 2 years. And it came out even as long as there were only 48 states. You know, you can divide that into three, but when two new senators were to be elected, a drawing was held on the Senate floor, and Senator Bartlett drew the tab that said he should run again in 1960, only 2 years after his original run, and Senator Greening drew a slip that said he was to run in 1962. Neither one got the what would have been the great prize, one that would have provided for a whole six-year term right off the bat. But they did run in those years, and each was reelected. In 1962, I moved up to Anchorage to run the senator's campaign, and we introduced what we thought were, for those times, very greatly improved campaign mechanisms. One of them was the first $100 a plate fundraising dinner, which was held in Anchorage. There had never been such a political feast in the history of Alaska. And nowadays, you know, it's almost laughable to think that it was only $100. But in those times, that was really thought to be hitting the ceiling. And we did raise some money that way. Another thing I introduced that time was I had the thought that the little posters that we were tacking up on barns and cabins and telephone poles and the like were not really big enough or persuasive enough. So I thought that one item that is procurable in every inhabited place of Alaska is a sheet of 4x8 plywood. So if we could get printed up a billboard made up of several sheets which paste together, we could take those into any place in Alaska and buy a sheet of plywood and paste the thing on and set it up someplace where everybody could see it, even if he was only driving by swiftly in an automobile. And so I have on my conscience the
street side billboard in Alaska.
That size billboard in Alaska, along with such other things as the $100 plate dinner. That campaign in 1962 cost about $200,000.
Still a lot of money.
Still a lot of money. You have to raise it. You know, you have to somehow get people to contribute it to the candidate. But in 1968, the final campaign, when Senator Greening was defeated in the primary by Mike Gravel, although we only got as far as the primary, we spent over $400,000. And I think that is a measure of how campaigns have become more elaborate and they've become more expensive. And I think they're going to keep on going up. The biggest expense by far nowadays in a political campaign statewide is in the cost of television advertising.
There's a great concern that this, especially the use of television, has replaced image with, or issue with image. Issue's
right.
Gone out the window.
And I think this was most evident in the 1958 campaign between Greening and Gravel. Gravel had a very persuasive film made, supposedly about his career, although we felt it had a lot of false claims in it. But it was played all over the state very effectively, and when the votes were counted, he had beaten Ernest Greening. Greening was at that time 81 years of age. He was running for a term which was going to last for 6 years. He insisted on coming to Alaska and speaking in every inhabited place, and the effect, I think, on the people who saw him and heard him was that this was, in truth, a very old man. And the fact was that had he been elected, he would not have served out his term, because he did die in 1974. He was still a great man, even though old. And in his own mind, he was not old. He said repeatedly, as long as a man is still effective and if he feels well and is able to get out and do the job, he's just as good as a young man. But the perception is not the same in the electorate, which, you know, I think largely again by television has come to look for young, good-looking heroes rather than old men.
Sure. What do you think he'd think of his state now, his territory and his state?
Well, I think I know. He was very proud of the way Alaska had developed. He came up and traveled all over the state just the year before he died, and he told me that it was the happiest trip he had ever made to Alaska, that he saw so many of his dreams being fulfilled up here, and he met so many people who were so kind to him, even though he was no longer in public office. So it was a nice valedictory.
And that welcoming hand was still there, if not more so. And what do you think of this state after 30 years service to it?
Well, I think it's onward and upward with Alaska. There are some things about the current scene which I do not think are an unmitigated triumph. But I think that as long as we have statehood and self-government, we're going to get the kind of government we deserve, and we're going to have the kind of economic development we're willing to work for. And the tools are in the hands of Alaskans to make this the kind of a state they want, given to them by the Constitution and by the fact that they were admitted as a state of the United States. And now it's up to Alaskans.
Mm-hmm. George Sundberg, I want to thank you for spending an hour with me on KUAC. It's been a most interesting hour. We've sat with journalist, public servant, writer of two books, both of them very interesting, one Hail Columbia and the other Opportunity in Alaska. George Sundberg, today on KUAC FM. I'm Susan McInnes. Thanks very much for joining us today.
You've been listening to a rebroadcast of George Sundberg's conversation with host Susan McInnes, which originally aired on KUAC in 1989. You can listen to it again on the KUAC website. I'm Robert Hannon. Thanks for listening.